that was the beauty of the Alaska program in the late 70s, is that people had the foresight to understand, you know, the infancy of local planning.
The possible end of the coastal management program. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, the 1st of December. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Obama administration signals it will slowly move ahead with Arctic development.
We're still talking about massive areas in the Arctic potentially being open to leasing when we know for a fact that you cannot clean up oil if it's spilled in that environment.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com. And by Pan Air, operating since 1955 and providing 9 destinations with service to 36 communities throughout Southwest Alaska. Reservations and rates online at panair.com.
The Obama administration announced today that while it's blocking offshore drilling on America's east coast and the eastern Gulf of Mexico, it will proceed cautiously in the Arctic. It had been halted after the BP Deepwater Horizon blowout gushed millions of barrels of oil into the Gulf of Mexico. APRN's Libby Casey reports.
Interior Secretary Ken Salazar says while Wednesday's announcement does allow the scoping process in the Arctic to advance, it is not a green light for development.
Based on extensive studies that will include the environmental analysis as well as the number of oil spill response capabilities and other issues that we're concerned about, then we'll make a decision. So these are not decisions about moving forward yet with respect to leasing in any of these Arctic areas.
Back in March, the Interior Department canceled proposed lease sales in the Beaufort and Chukchi Seas. Salazar says that has not changed, but studies of those areas and Cook Inlet will proceed. The Obama administration could have blocked offshore drilling in the Arctic through the year 2017, as it did in the Atlantic Ocean and eastern Gulf of Mexico. That's what environmentalists and Alaska Native groups dependent on the Arctic for subsistence wanted to see happen. The Alaska Wilderness League's legal counsel, Peter Van Tine, is dismayed that the Arctic is not off the table, even as he welcomes requirements for environmental review and scrutiny.
The Arctic is still at risk. It's good that the Secretary keeps emphasizing the importance of science, the importance of the opinion of local communities, and having these open decision-making processes. But we're still talking about massive areas in the Arctic potentially being open to leasing when we know for a fact that you cannot clean up oil if it's spilled in that environment.
Environmentalists are applauding the decision to pull back in the Atlantic Ocean and Florida's Gulf Coast. The April BP oil rig blowout caused the Interior Department to scuttle drilling plans and reevaluate its programs. The spill took 5 months to stop and gushed more than 170 million gallons of oil into the Gulf of Mexico. Secretary Salazar says it had a lasting impact on policy and planning.
The changes that we are making today really are based on the lessons that we have been learning. And knowing that there is a robust safety regime that we are standing up to prevent another Deepwater Horizon incident from occurring again.
Salazar says the Interior Department will launch studies to inform his decision on whether to schedule Alaska leases in 2012 to 2017.
I also recognize that cautious, limited exploratory activities can help develop critical information about the Arctic and its resources. Those exploratory activities, however, must be conducted safely and with strong oversight.
Salazar points out that there's only one pending request to drill in the Arctic by Shell in the Beaufort Sea this summer. It was put on hold in the aftermath of the BP Gulf of Mexico spill, but Wednesday's announcement means the permitting process can resume. Michael Bromwich, director of the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, says first Shell must meet new standards now in place.
We are reviewing and processing Shell's application to drill a single exploratory well in the Beaufort Sea. We will move forward with a careful and complete review of Shell's application to determine if the project meets all existing and new safety standards, has robust oil spill response capabilities in place, and can move forward under strong oversight and inspection.
Shell has requested that a decision be made this month on its exploratory well permit so it can plan for the summer. But Bromwich says he will not be held to what he called artificial deadlines for approval. Shell Alaska spokesman Curtis Smith called Wednesday's announcement positive for the company.
Clearly, we've been stating all along that we need clarity on our 2011 program by the end of this year. It's our hope, based on today's announcement, that the administration is inclined to review our permit and give us feedback one way or the other before the end of the year.
If Shell gets permission to drill its Beaufort Sea exploratory well this summer, the Obama administration announced Wednesday a new policy of stationing safety personnel on site throughout the entire drilling process to watch and hold the company accountable. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
After more than 30 years, the doors are scheduled to close on one of the state agencies that has been most responsible for development projects in coastal communities. Right now, the Coastal Management Program faces a final lights-out closure on July 1st. The question legislators will have to resolve during next year's session is how or if it should be saved. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
Established in 1978, the Coastal Management Program was charged with being a one-stop source for developers and communities to work together on projects and as a central point for permitting, zoning, and scientific work to help develop the state. It gave communities along 44,000 miles of coastline the ability to have work done their own way. The goal was to develop the infrastructure for a still young state. It came at a time that long-range planning was a new idea, and it came to places that had no resources of their own to deal with fast growth. Anchorage, for example, used it to upgrade the Port of Anchorage, to build the Tony Knowles Coastal Trail, to oversee and encourage the vast amount of road construction and residential development that was built in the 80s and 90s. Thede Tobish is senior planner for the municipality, and he doubles as the coastal coordinator. He says all the work that was done during those years would not have happened without the program.
The basics for which it was founded remain, you know, the need for local controls, due deference in permitting and long-range development decisions, and, of course, budget assistance. Those issues remain.
He says the Alaska approach allowed local communities to decide for themselves what to offer.
And that was different than some states where it was top-down. The state said, here's the resources and here's how you're going to manage them. It was more prescriptive. And I think that was the beauty of the Alaska program in the late 70s, is that people had the foresight to understand, you know, the infancy of local planning and this networked approach where the state was a partner with the district.
Marlene Campbell is Government Relations Director for the City and Borough of Sitka, and as such is Coastal Management Coordinator, after having worked at various aspects of the program for 23 years. She says it strikes a balance between protection of natural resources and responsible development. About 95% of Sitka's managed area is federal land, and she says the program has been valuable by giving developers certainty by putting everything in one place.
Instead of people having to get a DEC permit, a Corps of Engineers permit, a state tidelands permit, a local use permit, any number of other agencies getting involved, the program unified the permitting process, and over the years has really been the one of the best things about the program.
Problems in the system began to boil over in the late 90s, Toby says, mostly because of a few controversial projects. The developers of those projects began to describe the program as an obstacle instead of a partner. The phrase used was that coastal management had veto power, and they still hold that opinion today. Campbell says that description doesn't fit, at least not in Sitka. The local council has never vetoed a project, although they have suggested alternative places for more appropriate development. But there's never been a complaint about the results from any of their interventions.
One of the places that coastal management can help, both in terms of getting projects permitted in the best places and limiting the adverse impacts to the community and to the environment, is ensuring that if there is some tweaking that could be done to make the project more appropriate and it's not going to damage the project, that in fact, that's entirely appropriate to do.
Those controversial projects, however, began to boil over to the point where Governor Frank Murkowski rewrote the program by executive order and then by statute. Environmental conservation was set apart, and local communities were not given the same level of input, the same due deference. A bill last year would have restored some of the program to pre-Murkowski strength, but it didn't pass. Its sponsor, Nome Senator Donnie Olson, recognized the opposition and says the changes still need to be made. He says he'll try to get a one-year extension of the coastal management program as it is now, with hope that new legislators and new members of the administration will help get the basics reestablished. If it does expire, Campbell says the contacts will go away. Instead of working a project for Sitka under the state authority, she says she'll be limited to meeting developers and giving them a list of phone numbers of federal and state agencies that they will need to satisfy on their own. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
Alaska state troopers have arrested a suspect in the fatal stabbing of a Brevik Mission man. Troopers were notified of the death early yesterday morning. From Nome, KNOM's Ben Matheson has the story.
29-year-old Jessica Olana was arrested yesterday following the death of her boyfriend, 35-year-old Andrew Taktu of Brevik Mission. Nome Trooper Ann Sears is working the case.
She was identified immediately. I mean, she was in the house and said that she had stabbed Andrew when both the health aide and the village police officer showed up after they both had gotten a call.
Olana was transported to Nome yesterday and booked at Anvil Mountain Correctional Center. Olana is being charged with manslaughter. Sears says the troopers are thankful for the support and assistance of the community of Brevik Mission.
Definitely to the folks in Brevik Mission, the health aide and the village police officer, and then the village public safety officer, who is Chris Votruba, their assistance, their first response in having to deal with this before the troopers got there. I mean, not enough can be said. I mean, they were having to deal with this tragedy. Folks that, they live with, work with, see in the community every day, dealing with not only the death, but then, taking into custody Jessica at the same time.
Brevik Mission is a community of 275 people located about 65 miles north of Nome. I'm Ben Matheson.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, help for a family comes through social media after a home fire.
Immediately I grabbed a coat that I knew had bullets in it, and I knew bullets were going to be going off if I didn't get them out of there.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, and by Pin Air, with 50 years of flying experience and offering charter service throughout Alaska and the United States. Details online at pinair.com.
Alaskans will see an increase in the state's unemployment insurance tax rate in 2011. The rate for employers set by a formula in state law will go up about 0.5%. The employee rate will rise slightly from its current 0.5% minimum. Despite the increases, Alaska's 2011 rate for employers will be the fifth lowest in the last 31 years. That's according to Virginia Calloway, chief of unemployment insurance taxes with the State Department of Labor. She says one reason is the state's unemployment insurance trust fund has more than $200 million in the bank.
Which is a positive for us. That means that we have been able to pay benefits and not have to borrow.
Meanwhile, Congress yesterday failed to pass an extension of federal unemployment insurance, meaning thousands of Alaskans will start losing their benefits in the coming weeks and months. The state provides 26 weeks of regular benefits, which Congress had extended to 99 weeks through four separate bills. Tom Nelson, director of employment security at the Labor Department, says more than 35,000 Alaskans received unemployment insurance during the last week of November. Of those, more than 10,000 got some form of federal benefits. New claims for one federal extension expired last week. Another expires December 11th. And one extension the federal government had been paying 100% will now be split 50-50 between the state and feds.
It will affect our trust fund somewhat in that we've got a lot of filers right now who are still eligible for that extended benefit. So it just means that, during this high period of unemployment, this winter, it will be funded more out of our trust fund than it has been during the past year.
Alaska is one of only three states, along with Pennsylvania and New Jersey, where employees help fund the system along with employers. One Akiak man says he has a lot to be thankful for, even after a house fire destroyed all of his possessions on Thanksgiving Day. KYUK's Shane Iverson has more.
It was a quiet Thanksgiving evening in the Kuskokwim village of Akiak. Jerry Atatayuk was lounging in his in-law's house, full after an afternoon of feasting. His wife, Faith, told him she was going home to relax, but Atatayuk was too full to move. Faith left on a four-wheeler, but returned quickly.
And she said, "There's water spraying out of our house." And I was like, "Whoa, what's going on?"
Atatayuk says he pulled himself up to go inspect his house. He was not at all prepared for what would occur when he walked in.
By opening the door, the oxygen hit the wall, and just the flame just ignited, and the big fireball came at me.
Fearing for his life, Atatayuk says he took time to grab just one item.
Immediately, I grabbed a coat that I knew had bullets in it, and I knew bullets were going to be going off if I didn't get them out of there.
Friends and neighbors descended on the home with fire extinguishers. They were able to save the structure, but nothing inside.
After it happened, me and my wife were pretty emotional, and you know, all the stuff you worked for so long, you hate to see it go so fast. And from being so depressed and stressed out, I got sick, and that made me weak.
The Atatayuks moved in with a brother. Meanwhile, friends and family had already been busy using their cell phones to send out text messages. The messages called for donations to be sent to the family. And as the holiday weekend ended, Atatayuk says boxes started coming in from all over.
Platinum, Akiai, Good News Bay, Etnaslok.
The list goes on and on. Atatayuk rattles off more than a dozen villages from the YK Delta and other parts of the state. And that's not all.
It's Rhode Island.
Rhode Island, huh? Who do you guys know anyone in Rhode Island?
Yeah, we got a teacher here that she's from there, and she got the church down there to donate, too.
Atatayuk says his wife now has plenty of clothing, and they've gotten plenty of household items. After a few days of having nothing, he says he and his wife are now a lot less worried about how they'll get by. On top of stuff, Atatayuk says he's also been getting words of encouragement, not just from people near him, but also relatives he keeps up with on the social website Facebook.
Everybody just keeps saying, you know, just be thankful that we got each other, me and my wife, and just keep your chin up, and that's what I've been doing. Now, the past day or two, we've just been laughing about it now that what happened. I mean, it sucks. But all we can do now is just move forward.
Atatayuk has discussed the house fire with others in Akiak. He says they believe the fire was electrical, started by the heat tape that keeps the pipes from freezing. He says the water his wife was hearing came from the hot water tank, which blew out as the fire was getting started. Jerry and Faith Atatayuk will now stay with Faith's brother until they get another home. It may be some time. There's a housing shortage in the village already. It won't be easy, but as they pick up what's left, Atatayuk says the experience has shown him he has more support than he ever imagined.
Words can't say enough for what people are saying and doing for us, and I'll give it back to whoever, you know, in the end.
And if this holiday season wasn't memorable enough, the Atatayuks are expecting their first child to be born sometime around Christmas. I'm Shane Iverson.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Fire Island Wind, offering a renewable energy alternative to natural gas for South Central Alaska. Information at fireislandwind.com.
The 20th annual Tribal Providers Conference, going on in Anchorage throughout this week, has drawn hundreds of participants from villages across Alaska. The gathering is sponsored by the Federal Interior Department's Bureau of Indian Affairs and presents dozens of workshops and informational sessions on topics ranging from health and foster care to tribal government issues. Yesterday afternoon, one session filled an entire ballroom at the Egan Center with those eager to find solutions to the high rate of suicide among Alaska Natives. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports.
The Indian Health Service and the Interior Department's Indian Affairs is holding 10 tribal listening sessions across the nation in the next few weeks to seek input on how agencies can work within Native communities on suicide prevention. Alaska's only listening session was scheduled to coincide with the Tribal Providers Conference in Anchorage this week. Participants in Tuesday's listening session were encouraged to step up to an open microphone and speak about their experiences, and at first, only a few braved speaking in front of such a large audience. Rob Sanderson Jr. from Heidelberg, a young single father, said he faced alcohol and drug problems too, but cleaned up his act for the sake of his son. Education starts at home, he said.
Our children leave our villages here in Alaska and they try to go out and make it in the Western world and they fail miserably. And I'm a good example of that. It took a long time to get back to where I'm at now. I am one person that struggled with alcohol and drugs. Before leaving here today, I hope that this group can come together with some kind of plan that you can take back to D.C.
Sanderson said 25 people were lost in his Haida village alone during his lifetime, three of them from his high school graduating class. That's far too many. After the first handful of speakers stood up, the floodgates opened and long lines formed behind each microphone. People respectfully waited their turn to tell of personal heartache.
A lot of us come from dysfunctional families. That's the life we've learned. That's the life I've learned. I had started using alcohol at a very young age. I went to school under the influence sometimes, you know. I lived it. I breathed it.
We need someone there with the people. We need the monies to be allocated to someone that lives in their village who knows about psychology, about how to deal with depression, suicides. I'm happy I had my grandparents. They helped me out a lot.
Suicide rate in Alaska is so high that we lose 3 natives every week. That seems to me incomprehensible.
Many elders who had been active in tribal government for years spoke for communities riddled with grief over the deaths of young natives. Peter Moore from Emonic recalled how he was raised by soft-speaking grandparents compared with many of today's mothers who scream at their children, he said. The children's ears become plugged, he said. That's why they can't listen. James Sippery, who has lost a son to suicide, helped plan 3 Nelson Island conferences on suicide where professionals were brought in to discuss alcohol and drug abuse, the use of inhalants, and domestic violence.
And I for myself, I talk about myself, what about my responsibilities as a parent to my children and my grandchildren?
Sippery said that type of education is needed and more funds are needed to provide it. There is no magic wand, he said. We must don armor and declare war on suicide.
Because we've lost it. 14 to 15 young people in 2 years alone. We lost 2 little boys overdosed in inhaled gasoline.
Janice Jackson, an Indian child welfare worker from Ketchikan and the grand president of the Alaska Native Sisterhood, told the Washington, D.C. representatives about the concept of generational grief.
As Native people, we carry the trauma and the experiences that our ancestors went through before us. We carry the hurt. And it's always been a concept that has been widely accepted in the Native community that we carry the grief of the generations before us.
Jackson says the trauma that the elders went through affected their DNA, and those changes have been passed on to succeeding generations. She says now there is scientific evidence backing that concept.
You know, our folklore of Native generational grief that we inherited, in fact, is true based on scientific data now.
Some attending the listening session called for the state and the tribes to work more closely together on the issue of suicide. The tribal listening sessions are being held across the country in preparation for a national suicide prevention conference planned for next year. Next year's conference is aimed at developing strategies for suicide prevention in Alaska Native and American Indian communities. The listening sessions are expected to help the agencies involved to gather information on the needs of communities to better shape the goals of the conference. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska's commercial halibut fishermen are facing another major cut to the coast-wide catch in 2011. Scientists with the International Pacific Halibut Commission are recommending a total harvest of a little more than 41 million pounds of the valuable flatfish in Alaska, Canada, and the Pacific Northwest. That would be a 19% drop from last year's overall catch limit. Southeast would be particularly hard hit again, with a potential 47% cut. From Petersburg, KFSK's Matt Lichtenstein reports.
IPHC staff made the recommendations after a 2.5-hour presentation on their scientific survey and assessment methods during the commission's interim meeting in Seattle Tuesday. About 50 people listened in to a public webinar available over the internet. While it varies by area, quantitative scientist Stephen Hare explained that overall halibut stocks remain on the decline.
As has been the case now for a number of years, there's been a coastwide decline in the catch rate of halibut on the survey. Coast-wide, the decrease is about 15% over last year, and even if this represents a steady and ongoing decline here, a total of more than 50% over the course of when we implemented full-scale surveys back in 1997. But the decline varies by area, of course.
Under the recommended limits, Southeast Alaska's Area 2C catch would again take the biggest hit percentage-wise, with a limit of about 2.3 million pounds. That's a little more than half of this past year's catch. Southeast fishermen have already seen their quota drop by 60% over the past half decade. Quotas measured in weight, not numbers of fish, and according to Hare, the drop in numbers has been accompanied by a bigger decline in weight for legal-sized halibut.
And while there is a coastwide decline in catching numbers, you know, it's relatively modest in comparison to what's happened to the weight of the fish that are over 32 inches.
Staff is recommending a cut of 28% for the Central Gulf of Alaska Area 3A with a proposed limit of just under 14.4 million pounds. The staff recommendation for the Western Gulf Area 3B is 7.5 million pounds for a reduction of 24%. On the brighter side, researchers continue to see large numbers of young halibut along the coast, but according to Hare, they've been slower to recruit or to grow to legal size.
Everybody seems to agree there's lots of young fish. They're simply not recruiting very rapidly into the exploitable part of the biomass in large measure because the growth rates have continued to decline.
The data showed some improvement in the Pacific Northwest Coast Area 2A and British Columbia Area 2B. For 2A, staff is proposing a 6% boost to 860,000 pounds, while Area 2B would go up about 2% with a catch of 7.65 million pounds. The Aleutians Area 4A and B would see limits at about 2.4 and 2.2 million pounds, which represent increases of 3% and 1% respectively. Bering Sea Areas 4, C, D, and E would also see a small boost of 4% with just over 3.7 million pounds. The Commission of U.S. and Canadian Representatives will not make a final recommendation on the limits until its annual meeting in January. In Petersburg, I'm Matt Lichtenstein.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at aprn. We had reports tonight from Ben Matheson in Nome, Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Shane Iverson in Bethel, Casey Kelly in Juneau, and Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
And by
Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for over 50 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. Crowley.com.
The Alaska Public Radio Network, in cooperation with our member stations, provides the most complete, timely, and accessible source of Alaska news, current affairs, and cultural information.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.